On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, Justine Hamilton and I revisit the concept of fear and how it affects us in our life and how to deal with it in a more graceful way. I think the conversation is really wonderful, and I really hope that you guys enjoy our conversation about managing fear in a graceful manner. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, Justine Hamilton and I are going to talk about a subject that started the podcast in the first place. We're going to revisit the topic of fear. Haven't had a podcast on that topic in a long time, even though it's a part of almost every episode we put out. But I thought it was a good idea to revisit fear and how it works in our lives and how it doesn't work and what the best ways are to work with it and so on and so forth. So welcome, Justine.
Thank you, Dana. I'm so afraid to have this conversation.
No. So fear, what do we say about fear? It's normal. It's a huge part of all of our lives. We would not survive a day without it, which I think is sometimes hard for people to accept. But if you think about driving your car, you drove here. I'm assuming that when red lights show up, that you stop.
I do.
I hope you do anyways. I know that not everybody does, but those are people who don't recognize how important it is to respect their fear.
Mm-hmm. I know some people like that. Yeah. Drivers in my family.
But, you know, really, I think one of the main reasons why we experience the emotion of fear is to preserve our lives, to keep us alive.
So where does it start? Like, are we born with fear? Does it come in because things happen to us? Like, where does it start, this emotion?
Well, I wish I could say with 100% authority that we're born with it. I do believe that. Mm-hmm. I've met people. I know somebody actually who was one of the first premature babies in Santa Barbara to survive. He was born probably 2.5 pounds, mm-hmm. and you could fit him in the palm of your hand. And for the first 3 months of his life, he almost died every day. When I met him, he had post-traumatic stress left over from being resuscitated over and over again.
Wow.
As a premature baby. Now, we look at him as a miracle. And if you met him now, there is no way that you would ever know he started his life this way. Mm-hmm. He's a very healthy 30-year-old, you know, person who had a really rough start to life.
Yeah.
But he looks completely normal. And I don't think that we realize in situations like that, that fear becomes imprinted on a really deep level.
And that you're probably born with it.
Yeah, because he was not designed to survive. Mm-hmm. And only through medical technology were we able to keep him alive.
Right.
And he was actually, when I first met him, diagnosed as being bipolar. And when I met him, I thought, this guy doesn't have a bipolar bone in his body. He's got post-traumatic stress. And luckily, he was able to get off all of those medicines that weren't doing him any good and understand that his beginnings in the world were what traumatized him.
How'd you find that out? I know a little off topic, but how did you relate it back to him being premature and his...
Well, as soon as he told me his beginnings, I thought, well, of course, this makes complete sense. Mm-hmm. If you're almost dying every day, mm-hmm. and they have to resuscitate you, everything is you're on alert. Right. And all the nurses and doctors and everybody around you is on complete alert 24 right. hours a day, trying to make sure that you're okay. And right. I think that energy gets expressed right in, big time all around you.
Got it.
So that's kind of an extreme version, but I think that really fear is often looked at as the problem. But my belief is that fear is not an issue. It's how you deal with it that determines whether it's problematic or not.
And I would assume most of us don't always deal with it in the right way.
Well, whether we do it right or wrong, I think that what we're conditioned to do is to turn it into aggression. Mm-hmm. And people are always surprised when, especially somebody that might be referred to me for what we would call anger management, mm-hmm. or they've been told by their spouse or their friends or whatever, God, you're so angry all the time.
Right.
And the person comes in and, you know, says, I have an anger problem. And my response is, that's not true. You have a fear problem or a pain problem, but because it's hard to stay with those feelings, you turn it into aggression. And this is a huge generalization, but men are generally conditioned to take their fear out on other people in the form of aggression.
And what do women usually do?
Take it out on themselves.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. And what I mean by that is that, and this is, again, is not, it's a huge generalization because I know plenty of men that take their fear out on themselves. Mm-hmm. And I know a fair number of women that take their fear out on other people. So, yeah. But as a woman, aren't you generally told that there's something, that you're like a bitch or something if you express your anger?
Dina!
Well, think about it.
Yes.
That, yeah. I mean, you know, men are encouraged to be aggressive. Exactly. Women are shamed for being aggressive.
Over and over and over. And I think our society has not learned yet. I think we haven't evolved at all when it comes to that.
Yeah.
Whereas still, well, to this day.
I mean, again, I think it can happen on micro levels and macro levels. I think that one of the main reasons why Hillary Clinton lost the election to Trump is because she is an inherently really rage-filled person. The anger oozes out of her pores. At least that was my experience in watching her, that there's anger there all the time. Mm. And I think it's because she's been victimized a lot, and also that, you know, were not very nice to her.
Well, yeah, and she was playing in that arena. Where... Uh-huh.
And that is an arena of people deliberately trying to hurt their opponents on purpose.
Right.
But getting back to the issue of how we manage fear, it's almost like there's a light switch in all of us that turns our fear into aggression. Because if you're aggressive, it gives you the feeling like you have control over what it is that is troubling you.
Yeah.
And if you stay with the fear or the pain, it makes you feel even more vulnerable. And most of us don't want to go anywhere near our vulnerability because we already feel that way in the first place. Otherwise, why would we get mad?
Right.
So if you look at every situation that you've ever been angry in and you're willing to take a step back and look at it, it's probably because you are afraid of something or hurt by someone or something or a combination of both. Mm-hmm. And that you learn, like most people do, to turn it into aggression because it gives you a feeling of control over what's happening.
Yeah. Do we look, or do we turn it into anything else besides aggression? Like,
The only alternative to aggression is staying with the vulnerability.
Okay, so that's it.
The options are quite limited because you can't turn fear into comfort. You can't turn, I mean, fear creates a chemical reaction that makes you want to fight or run from whatever it is that is happening.
What about people that, is there a situation where you feel fear, but that turns itself into maybe sadness and not aggression, or?
Well, the sadness again would be a function of the pain that would create the anger.
But maybe you're not angry. Maybe you're just sad.
Well, that's healthy to deal with the sadness directly because then it's not being turned into anger.
Right.
But most people get angry when they're sad or when they feel hurt. They get mad at the person that, in quotes, hurt them. And there's a four-year-old in all of us that wants to hurt back. Mm-hmm. And we are encouraged in some arenas of our world to hurt people on purpose that are frightening to us or that are conceived of as our enemy.
Right.
And the small versions of that, I mean, before the podcast, we were talking about communication in relationships. Mm-hmm. And the fact that when people argue with each other, they're usually trying to be right and the other person be wrong.
Right.
Right? It's the most common thing that happens is you want to prove to the other person that they're wrong.
Yeah.
And you want them to concede their wrongness so that you can feel right.
So you win.
Right?
Yeah.
That is a way of dealing with your vulnerability in a very unhealthy way because what's really happening underneath the struggle for right and wrong is a feeling of vulnerability. You hurt me, and I want to hurt you back by making you wrong because you hurt me. Instead of saying, you really, really hurt me. And it's very painful when these kind of things happen and you heard me. Mm-hmm. It was so much easier for me to say, you whatever, you know, you suck. Yeah. How could you do that to me? What's wrong with you? And all of that other stuff, because then I can feel a sense of power over my being vulnerable to the fact that you hurt me.
Right.
Or that you scared me in some way.
And that's what the real fear is being vulnerable around.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if I am in a relationship with you, I am inherently dependent on you to be kind to me and to be respectful of me. But if I do something that hurts you or scares you, then I am jeopardizing that connection in some way.
Yeah.
So what you're going to do is get mad at me and put me in my place, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, and make sure that I know that I'm wrong or I did something wrong or that I screwed up in some way so that you don't ever have to feel that threat to our connection.
Right.
Which is based in fear. It's not an anger thing. It's that you want to be able to rely on me and not feel like our connection is ever going to be jeopardized no matter what happens between us.
So how do we fix this?
Well, what I try to help people do is recognize that anger is what I would call a secondary emotion. It's always a reaction to other feelings.
Always a secondary emotion.
Always. People don't get angry for any direct reason. They get angry because they're trying to figure out a way to feel strong in the face of vulnerability. At least that's what I believe. I can't, you know, tell you with absolute certainty because it's what I believe, mm-hmm. but I've yet to find an instance where somebody has taken a step back and not recognized that the reason they got mad is because they felt really vulnerable in some way.
Right.
They were scared or hurt or both. And so part of what I try to help people recognize is that if you want your relationships to improve, then despite how scared you are or how vulnerable you're feeling, you got to stay with those feelings mm-hmm. and make sure that if it's appropriate, obviously, if the power differential conceivably is equal mm-hmm. as partners, we have equal sort of power, that I share with you how I feel in a vulnerable way as opposed to getting mad at you for, in quotes, scaring me or hurting me.
So let's role play for a minute.
Okay.
Well, let's pretend like we're married.
Okay.
Let's see. I'm going to be mad at you about something.
Okay. So what did I do that created that feeling of anger in you?
Let's see.
Or what didn't I do that I should have?
I feel like you are not listening to my needs. That's
okay.
Big and generic, and I think affects a lot of people.
Yeah. So how does it feel when somebody that you love is not listening to your needs?
It feels lonely. It feels sad. It feels like you're unimportant.
Uh-huh. And how much does those feelings hurt?
Oh, those are terrible feelings.
Okay. So what is the likelihood of you saying to me, oftentimes I feel really lonely and I feel like I don't matter enough to you and that I feel really scared that you don't love me as much as I want you to? How often would you say those words as opposed to, you bastard, what the fuck is wrong with you? You're never nice to me. You don't ever hug me. You don't do nice things for me, or you always do this, or you never do that, or
yeah.
or all the ways.
I think I'd be in the middle.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to pick on you.
Yeah, no.
Directly. I'm just saying that.
Yeah, I think it's
what you're going to do is get mad at me for not meeting your
needs.
Exactly. Instead of being honest with me by saying, I'm really scared that you don't love me in a way that I need to be loved. And that makes me feel really vulnerable. And I hate that feeling because, you know, it reminds me of my whole life of never feeling like anybody loved me and so on and so forth. If you said those things to me, I might be much more receptive to wanting to please you and take care of you than if you tell me I'm an asshole and that I'm wrong and that I have to eat shit in order to make you feel better.
Yes. But if you don't say you understand that, then you're really in big trouble. Meaning, like, if I tell you all those things and then you don't say, oh, yeah, I get it, or oh, I do love you, if you just say, I don't know what you're talking about, then we got a whole new problem.
Well, but, yes, that's a risk you take when you're being vulnerable. That's why people don't do it, because they don't want to be further hurt when they're already feeling hurt.
Right.
And so, I don't think you're crazy for protecting yourself. I will tell you it's not going to help your relationship very much.
Right, but, or the arguments,
Because, I mean, think about what it feels like to be wrong. How much do you like that feeling?
Oh, I'm the worst.
Everybody's the worst. Nobody wants to feel wrong, because to feel wrong means that you're a bad person and that it's humiliating to be wronged. And that's why fighting about who's right and who's wrong doesn't ever accomplish anything except escalate the pain and defensiveness.
Yeah. I think some people have an easier time than other people in being wrong, though. And maybe they're just a little bit more enlightened or...
I'm not sure, but really, I'm not sure. Because if you have to say that you're wrong, it's basically saying, I have no value because I'm a wrong person. There's something wrong with me.
But I think if you are a smart person, you can be like, I have value. I'm just wrong in that moment.
Well, but what if that's not the issue? What if I wasn't wrong? What if I was doing something or not doing something based on my needs and my feelings? It doesn't make me wrong. It just makes those moments incompatible.
True.
If that makes sense.
True.
And again, these are ideals. And, you know, find me anybody who lives an ideal emotional life.
Right.
It's a hard sell. It's very difficult for people to be willing to take a step back and admit, especially if they're already feeling hurt or scared.
Yeah, and in the heat of the moment. Uh-huh. So how does that pattern ever get broken other than you know what you're supposed to do, but the fear is doing it?
Well, again, it's a question then becomes a question of courage and how much the relationship matters to you.
Right, but I'm talking about, you know you should do it. You know that you should be vulnerable or step back. But how in the heat of like this conversation where you feel like you've just been hurt, like let's say you are feeling like, oh, I don't feel valued or whatever. What is the crux where it comes in and you're like, okay, wait, stop. I'm going to reassess this and I'm going to be like, no, I'm hurt and I this is my thing and... You know, I'm feeling really lonely. How do you switch that dynamic? Like,
well, sometimes the best way to do it is to not say anything, but go up to the person and put your arms around them and let them feel how much you love them.
Well, that's really vulnerable too, Dana.
Of course it is. That it makes you even more vulnerable because you can't use your words to defend yourself.
Yeah.
You're just showing the person how much you love them by embracing them and helping them feel like you really do love them, despite the fact that we're not always on our best behavior.
Do you ask your clients to do that? When
all the time. I'm not sure how much cooperation I get. Sometimes I do. A lot of times I probably don't.
Yeah.
Because we are so invested in protecting ourselves.
Right.
And there's a little kid in all of us that's been wronged and made to feel so shamed that we'll do almost anything to avoid tapping into those feelings again.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you, in my relationship with my wife, I often get angry. Because
she's a saint. You can't get angry.
I know, and everybody tells me that. So that's not lost on me. But one of the first things I do when I get mad about something is to remind myself, or to ask myself, how important is it that I make an issue of this situation right now? And if I and then what is it I'm really feeling underneath the anger?
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example?
I can be mad at my wife for not taking care of herself emotionally, not sticking up for herself.
Mm-hmm.
That's been an issue only since the beginning of our relationship 50 years ago, because she was taught by her family that it matters way more what people think of you than how you feel about yourself.
Uh-huh.
And she knows it. She's very, very, she's done enough therapy to understand that that's her Achilles heel in
yes.
a certain way. But when it comes to her family, because they were conditioned to be afraid of each other and mm-hmm. to be afraid of hurting each other and letting each other down, it's really, really hard for all of them to be honest with each other and talk about how they really feel about things. And so I watch, and I am an incredibly protective person mm-hmm. of the people that I love, maybe to a fault. Because I was not protected as a kid.
Right, right.
And so I made a vow that I would never leave my family or my friends or anybody that I love unprotected.
Mm-hmm.
And that I'll do anything to take care of them under whatever circumstances are necessary. Which I realize sometimes makes me a huge pain in the ass. Because she can have forgiven the person that's hurt her. And I'm still wanting to punch him in the
mm-hmm.
head.
Mm-hmm.
Because don't fuck with my wife. Don't mm-hmm. hurt my children. Don't, you know. And so she can let it go, but I have a really hard time letting it go.
So you'll stop. And I mean, you guys have been married for a long time and yeah. this dynamic has been going on. And I'm sure there've been times where you were super annoyed about it.
Uh-huh.
And she's just like, it's fine, whatever.
Well, I remind myself that it's not my problem, number one. And I also take stock of who I would rather live with, her or me. And I know that sounds funny, but I can tell you how many times I've reminded myself, you don't want to live with you. It's a miracle that anybody has been willing to do that for all these years. So how maybe about being a little bit gracious? Well, how about being gracious and taking a step back and being grateful that somebody who's, and I don't think I'm a bad person. I don't mean it from that perspective.
Yeah.
But I also know that I'm not an easy person to live with. I'm super fussy and I like things a certain way. And, you know, I can be very dogmatic and, you know, I'm not afraid to express myself because I don't care what other people think of me mostly. I care about what the people I love think of me and the people that I care about. But if you're not part of that list of people,
yeah,
I could give a shit what you think about me, which is really annoying to the people, you know, that are in a relationship with me.
Well, isn't it interesting that the two of you found each other?
Yeah, because we're diametrically opposite in that way.
Yes.
You know?
So over the years, sort of back to what we were talking about, over the years, you would just have to kind of stop yourself instead of letting it escalate and you getting mad at her for letting her family push her around.
Yeah, I got to keep my mouth shut because she's the one that has to find the courage.
Yeah.
So
did that
really,
get easier over time?
Well, I think what I try to do is tell her that I'm really sorry that it's so hard for her to take care of herself and that I don't think it's a question of confusion about what to do. I think it's a question of finding the courage to do what you know you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And usually if I can approach it from that perspective, she's more receptive because it's true. It's not a question of confusion. Most of the time when people tell me they're confused, it's not true.
But I have to tell you, that might make me mad.
If I said that I'm sorry that you don't have the courage to take care of yourself?
Yeah.
Well, I hope it makes you mad enough to take care of yourself.
Well, has it worked with her?
Well, she does an easy job with me. But that's because she trusts that I can handle her taking care of herself with me. There's no threat.
Yeah.
I'm not going to hold her hostage like her family does.
Right.
I'm not going to shame her for speaking her truth. I'm not going to make her feel bad for not sacrificing herself to take care of me.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. So it's a little bit easier for her to have, you know, to be able to put me in line if that's what's necessary, because that inherent threat of being shamed is not part of the picture.
So if we are probably sort of born with this and it's prevalent in all of our relationships forever and you just learn how to deal with it, how can we start learning how to deal, I don't know if deal is the right word, but how can we start learning to manage our fear in a more positive way or a better way where, you know, we don't feel so bad, we don't make other people feel bad, and it's just a little bit more cohesive, but there's still fear there because can't ever get rid of it entirely.
Well, I think that in some ways, then it becomes a spiritual issue in a way to find courage, to take care of yourself. Because most people are taught to be externally centered in the way they live their lives, to care a great deal about how other people see them and look at them and judge them and so on and so forth, because our parents condition us to believe that other people's opinions of us matter more than the way we feel about ourselves.
Right.
So part of what I try to help everybody do is become centered within themselves. Now, again, I want to make it clear, I've said this a million times, I'm not talking about being self-centered.
Yeah.
Because self-centered people are totally obnoxious and horrible to be around.
Yeah.
But being centered in yourself means that you have learned how to trust what your intuition is telling you. And it's much easier to deal with fear if you feel your truth emerging from inside of you when you have questions or when you have issues that you need to deal with, because it's like a feeling of not being alone in the world in a certain way. I mean, I got a million examples, but if I'm feeling vulnerable or scared about something that I need to come to terms with, in my personal way of dealing with that is to talk to God about it and say, hey, I'm feeling really vulnerable. I'm feeling really scared to make this decision because I can't at this moment tell the difference between my intuition and how scared I am.
Right.
So can you help me feel the difference? And I would say that 99 to 100% of the time, something happens in a relatively short period of time to help me know that I already knew the answer.
Right. And to have less fear around the decision.
And just to be able to come from that place of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really believe our intuition, again, is the voice of God inside of all of us.
Agreed.
The voice of your higher power. I don't care what word you want to use.
Yep.
That doesn't matter to me. But I think that the more that you're willing to sort of surrender to that as a sacred part of your existence, yeah, the easier it is to be able to face our fears in a healthy way.
Yeah. Let's say for parents out there of young kids, uh-huh, or, you know, 7-year-olds or whatever.
Yeah.
What advice would you give parents in teaching their children how to manage fear? You know, they're not necessarily paying attention to their intuition or, uh-huh, God conversations. Like, what would you say to those people to be like, okay, let's get this kid set up on the right track. So,
okay.
What would you do?
I can give you a personal example.
Yeah.
When my kids were pretty young, there's a stage that kids go through where they're afraid of monsters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very common fear.
Yep.
They start to realize the world is much bigger than they knew that it was. And so then they start being afraid of the unknown, afraid of the dark, and all the things that make, yeah, them feel super vulnerable. Most of the time what parents do is shame their kids into submission. There's no such thing as monsters. Get in your bed. Stop complaining. Mm-hmm. If you're not asleep, I'm going to give you something to be upset about, or, you know, all the different ways we make our kids feel bad about being afraid.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to do that because I was left alone to solve all of my vulnerabilities as a kid. And it was incredibly scary and painful. So I thought, okay, how do I help my kids feel safe when inherently they don't? And they're, yeah, not supposed to, because they're now experiencing the world in a way that they never have before.
Right.
So I went to the store and bought silly string. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
My kids,
still around.
My kids were not old enough to read yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought them each a can of silly string and I said, this is monster spray. So every night before we go to bed, we're going to spray all the monsters in the room.
Mm.
So that you can go to bed knowing that you've killed all the monsters for tonight. It was so much fun because we're running around the room squirting crap all over the place and killing all the monsters. And so I helped them understand that their fear was not the problem, that it's normal to be afraid,
yeah,
especially when you're scared of the unknown.
Right.
But there are ways that you can confront the unknown. And it was as simple as a silly string.
Yeah.
And that was age appropriate for them because they didn't know there wasn't such a thing as monster spray.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, yeah, sort of thing. When we would go to a restaurant when they were slightly older and they were hungry, obviously, and they wanted me to order for them because they were intimidated by the waiter or waitress. And I would say to them, sorry, but if you're hungry and you want to eat, you're going to have to tell the waiter or waitress what you want. No, Dad, I'm scared. What if they, you know? And I would say that I'm sitting here right next to you.
Yeah.
And you can hold my hand if you want to. And if it seems as though the waiter or waitress doesn't understand what you want, I will absolutely step in and clarify, but you need to learn how to talk to adults and tell them what you want and what you don't want, because there's nothing special about adults,
mm-hmm,
and that they have no more power than you do, even though they act like they do.
Right.
Because the person that's at this restaurant is working here to make sure that you get what you want.
Right.
And so that's why they're looking at you like, what do you want for dinner or whatever?
Yeah.
And, you know, of course they resisted, but, you know, At a certain point when they realized that I wasn't going to tell the waiter or waitress what, and they were hungry,
yeah,
they learned, yeah, how to do it pretty quickly. And it got to the point where actually I was pretty amazed at how present my children were with adults. They would look at adults in the eye. They wouldn't turn away like most of their, mm-hmm, friends, and they would tell people what was important to them.
Yeah.
Because I don't think being an adult is anything special. And I wanted my kids to know that they're as important as any adult in the world, and that, yeah, they're kids. And so, you know, they are subject to the authority of adults, and I want them to respect that. But at the same time, I don't want them to be afraid of adults.
Yeah.
Because unless you have a really good reason to be afraid of somebody, if they're mean to you or they go out of their way to try to hurt you, there's nothing about them that that you, in quotes, need to be intimidated by.
So it was really just letting them voice their fears and then letting them feel comfortable with them dealing with it and them sort of like getting in touch really with their own little intuition at that point, where it's like,
yes,
okay, let's, you know, think about this rationally. And it's like, what is my body telling me? And it's
and not
telling
to,
me I'm hungry.
Right. And not to feel alone.
Yeah.
Because I never wanted my kids to feel like they were alone in whatever it was that they were dealing with in their lives. Because I felt alone every moment of my existence as a little kid.
Yeah.
And it was really lonely and very painful and really scary.
Right.
I lived in terror my whole childhood because I felt so abandoned and alone by my parents and their crazy way of living in the world.
Do you ever, and I'm not asking you personally, but I hear stories about people that overcompensate, right? So kids that were left alone or kids that had like nothing, and then they have kids and they're like, well, my kid's never going to feel that, or, you know, or even like financial stuff or, you know, materialistic stuff. Do you ever feel like there's still a fear on some adults with their kids where they're overcompensating based on their own fears? And even though they think they're doing the right thing, they're actually doing the wrong thing because they're still fearful?
I believe that that happens only all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, I overcompensated by becoming incredibly aggressive. And by the time I was in second, third grade, I was beating the crap out of every kid I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
That was horrible. That was really mean and awful. Now, everybody around me was doing the same thing, so it appeared to be normal to be fighting all the time.
Yeah.
But I was a horrible bully, and I look back with such shame at how I handled my vulnerability. But by that point in time, I'd already been molested and abandoned and, you know, watched people die and got hit by a truck
afraid.
And all kinds of really horrible stuff that made me feel like the world was an incredibly unsafe place. And when I was in second grade, I wrote a story about watching people being killed that I saw. And the teacher sent a note home to my parents saying, there's something really wrong with your son. He has a very overactive imagination. And that was incredibly shaming because she didn't believe that what I saw was real.
Did your parents stick up for you?
No, they never stuck up because teachers were authority back then. And so they never said anything about it. They just kind of looked at me like, I think my son's a lunatic or who knows what. But I mean, I know what I saw and I know what I experienced, but it was so far beyond the teacher's middle-class values to be able to consider that, that it was not a story. It was a real tale about what I saw.
Yeah.
Because there were no other kids in my class that were subject to any of those things that happened to me.
Yeah.
So I was an oddball.
It's crazy.
In that way. But it was all about making me feel ashamed of being sensitive and being traumatized by the things that happened to me. So it just increased my anger.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense, right?
Yeah. And then by the time I got to junior high school, I found drugs, which gave me the ability to stop fighting.
Yeah.
But only because I was drugged myself into submission.
Right.
And that lasted.
When you're high.
Yeah. Lasted all the way through high school.
Yeah.
Which is quite sad when I look back on it.
Yeah.
That, you know, every day I was higher than a kite.
Yeah.
And that was to be able to survive how bad I felt about myself as a person.
Right.
Because I had no idea that I was angry. And I had no idea how much hurt and pain that I was in until I was about 17 and started therapy and realized that all of the depression and despair and loneliness that I felt was because I was completely mistreated and abandoned as a kid.
And why do you think you didn't know that you were sad and lonely? Because there wasn't a conversation around it, or it was a different time, or you were told that, you know, just be quiet and you just compartmentalized those feelings? Or
I was never told really to be quiet. My parents weren't like overtly mean people. They were just so preoccupied by their own problems. And my parents did not like each other.
Right.
That was so painfully obvious that they couldn't stand each other, even though they stayed married for almost 25 years.
Yeah.
They spoke to each other so disrespectfully all the time. And my dad was barely home.
Right.
And my mom was so anxious all the time that her body was in some part of the world, even though
she wasn't present.
Even though she was present.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way that I could ever feel that my mom existed as a person was that I would terrorize my little brother to the point where he would completely lose control of himself and go to our mom screaming and crying that I wouldn't stop teasing him. So she would come up to me and we would stand, you know, across from each other. And she would yell at me and tell me to stop. And I would look at her straight in the face and say to her, I can't hear you. Now, can you imagine how angry she must have gotten that this little bastard kid was right straight to her face, can't hear a word you're saying.
Oh, my God.
And for one...
I'm getting angry sitting here.
But I will tell you that in that moment, my mom arrived into her body. And I could breathe because she was there. It's like, oh, hey, my mom's here.
Interesting. Even though it was a terrible, like, in her body movement because she was
at least she was there.
Yelling,
And when I look back and I think, how crazy was it that I had to go to such an extreme in order to feel that my mother existed.
But why did you not know you were in that sort of pain? I mean, because I think about today, like, you know, in this day and age, and I think it's just because there's more awareness around mental health, et cetera. But, you know, every kid is like, I'm anxious. Not every kid, I'm generalizing. But, you know, kids are really in touch with their feelings way more than I feel like they ever were. And I think, you know, maybe everyone is a little bit more in touch with their feelings. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, and where I grew up, like you didn't talk about anything.
Right.
There were no feelings.
Exactly.
And, you know, I hear kids today and I see it on social media where they're talking about, oh, I'm anxious or I'm depressed or, you know, this feels great or, you know, I don't know what I want to do, but that's okay. Where in the past, it wasn't talked about. So do you think for you sort of not being aware of how crappy you felt was just part of the time or, you know, or the times or why did you not really understand how crappy you felt till later?
Well, I would say number one, because I was threatened with death when I was molested, I completely repressed that memory all the way until I was in my 30s.
Yeah.
So as that in the background, what reference point would I have had that something really terrible happened to me?
Mm-hmm.
All the other stuff that I went through was completely normalized.
Got it.
You know, it was just normal. And and there was no talk of depression or...
Yeah.
All I knew is that I was different than everybody else because I hated myself and I was super lonely. I was terrified of girls. All my friends had girlfriends. I never was able to sort of negotiate that world because I felt so bad about myself.
But you couldn't even really articulate that to yourself.
No, because I was high all the time.
Yeah, for that reason.
And before that, I was angry all the time. And back then, I was praised by my friends' fathers for being a good fighter. So they would actually encourage me to beat up kids in their neighborhood.
How is that helpful?
What's that?
You've come a long way.
Well, how is that helpful? I mean, you know, to be praised by my friend's parents for being good at fighting as a 10-year-old. This is just so stupid.
Yeah. Well, it still happens today. You know.
Yeah, because I was a man.
Could you imagine someone saying that to their daughter or their daughter's friend? Great job. You beat the crap out of that girl.
Well, I mean, it's not conceivable, really. But I will say that when my daughter was growing up, I was thrilled that she wanted to play sports because sports is a sanctioned way for young women and girls to be aggressive and not be shamed for it. She wouldn't even play on a girls' sports team until she was forced by the leagues, baseball and other leagues, to play on girls' teams.
She wanted to play on the boys' team?
Yeah, because she liked the aggression and and she liked the competition. Plus, she was adorable, so all the guys would follow around slobbering everywhere she went. But that didn't hurt much. She always had a really easy way with boys because they were so much more direct in how they lived in the world, and she just liked that.
Yeah. Is that still the same today, do you think?
Well, I mean, she's married and has kids and all that sort of thing.
I don't mean boys falling around slobbering, but does she still gravitate towards very direct people?
Yes. I know that most of her friends are chosen specifically because what she's told me is that a lot of her friends her age complain endlessly about their husbands and how awful their husbands
are. Annoying.
And she didn't want to hear that.
Yeah.
Because even though her husband may be annoying on occasion, that's not how she wants to spend her time, is complaining endlessly about her partner. So she gravitates toward women that either are in good marriages or don't spend all their time bagging on their husbands.
Right.
And she's really lucky because she lives in a neighborhood with like 20 kids on the street. And it's like one of those old fashioned neighborhoods from where I grew up.
Yeah.
And so there's always kids around, and they have the pool in the neighborhood. So they're all, you know, all the kids come to her house to swim, and it's a really lovely situation in that regard.
Yeah.
So it's different. I also got a hot tub when my kids were little because I wanted to help them relax without giving them alcohol as little kids. So we would all not, I mean, I was taking a bath all together in the hot tub.
Right.
And I wouldn't ask them about how they did in school or any of that stuff because I didn't want to condition them to be performance oriented.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to them about their friends and relationships and why do you think people do this? Why do you think that person did that? So that they would start to sort of develop an idea about what motivated the people in their lives. So they would get mad at me if I wouldn't talk to them with them, but I didn't feel like it.
Aww.
Because they so enjoyed the idea that we could talk about things that weren't related to how they were performing in the world.
Yeah, it's super important.
That's what I think. Yeah, and too. I think that the biggest mistake that I ever made was not letting my children fail.
That was the biggest mistake you ever made.
Uh-huh.
So there was fear behind that.
Totally.
And because?
Well, my father went from rags to riches to rags to riches to rags and then finally riches.
Mm-hmm.
And one weekend we might be living in a 5-bedroom house on acres. The next weekend we're living on an apartment building in the middle of shithole Los Angeles because he lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
So his continued failures every time he got really successful were really troublesome because it meant that I had to move somewhere and I had to leave my friends or wherever. And it was incredibly painful because I'm a homebody. I mean, I remember once living in a house when I was about 12 and it was the longest house I'd ever lived in my life. And I remember sitting with my dad and making him promise me that we would never move again because I love the house and I love my friends and I love everything about what my life was all about. And he promised me that we would never move. And then 2 weeks later, I came home to a for sale sign in front of my house.
Oh, God.
And I remember going in the garage and getting a hammer and just destroying that for sale sign.
Wow.
And he came outside, what the fuck are you, you know? And I said to him, you promised. He said, sorry, I changed my mind.
Oh, that's
and
terrible.
So, you know, 2 weeks later, we lived in a different city.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a disaster because the business he bought completely failed and he almost went to jail. And we ended up back in Los Angeles in some shithole apartment.
Oh, gosh.
And the same thing happened. We were living there and I was getting adjusted and enjoying myself because it was actually a really lovely place we moved to. But he lost everything. And so he said, get your stuff. We're moving this weekend.
That's terrible.
So it was not a fearless, it was a very sort of fear-filled childhood.
Yeah.
And so I think all of that stuff really terrorized me.
So when you had your kids, you were like...
Well, when I decided to get married, I said to my wife, I know that you are a wanderlust person who would love to travel the world, but you're marrying a homebody.
Yeah.
So we're either going to be in the house we live in for the rest of our lives, but if we get another one, that's the house we're going to live in forever. So in the last 40, well, even longer than that, 40 some odd years, I've, you know, lived half a block from one of the... For the first house and been in this house for 30 some odd years because I was able to craft my own destiny based on my need for that feeling of security.
Yeah. Yeah.
Super important to me.
Yeah. For a good reason.
Yeah.
But you were saying that you didn't let your kids fail and that was just, that was the biggest mistake that you had.
Yeah. Because when my kids were growing up, there was this huge movement to preserve our children's fragile sense of self. So we would go to soccer tournaments and everybody got a trophy, no matter whether they were in first place or at the very last. And I think, what the, this is so stupid. Why would you give somebody a trophy for not winning? And it's not that I cared who won. That wasn't the point. The point was, what's the motivation if you're not like rewarded in sports for doing a really good job?
Yeah.
And when they were in school, if they ever struggled, we made sure that they passed whatever they needed to pass, especially my wife with my daughter who had some learning issues. And then when she was on her own, she was not equipped at all to handle perceived failure. And it was really painful to watch her fail a couple times. And she was already 18, maybe 19 years old.
Before she first really felt that.
Yeah. And I think it was really humiliating for her because she wasn't used to.
Yeah.
Because anything she ever did everybody loved her and rewarded her handsomely for it.
So if you had to do it differently, if she was failing a class or something in eighth grade, or
I would have let it happen.
You would have let it happen. But back then you wouldn't have.
No.
And that was just based on your fear of, like, I have to create this stable environment because I didn't have that. And I care so much about my family because no one cared about mine.
Absolutely. That is the truth. I did not want them to suffer in any way that I did. And I think that they realize now that they've had a pretty sweet life because they seem to be enjoying their lives. But it was painful to watch when, because who doesn't occasionally fail in their life?
Right, right. It's so hard.
It's really hard.
Just want to help.
Because our poor little monkeys are so fragile.
Yeah.
And they're not really.
But they're yours. They're your little babies.
Well, because, you know, I adored my child. I adore my kids.
Right.
They're not even kids anymore. They're adults.
Yeah.
So why would you want your kids to suffer in any way?
Yeah, no. It's the hardest thing to watch, I think.
But it doesn't necessarily build resilience if you don't really recognize what you bring to the table. And luckily, things have worked out well for both of them.
Yeah.
They live relatively charmed lives. So far, so good.
Right.
I think the hardest thing for them is dealing with their father's physical problems.
Right.
Because, you know, that's not easy to see.
Yeah. And are you seeing how your daughter Erin is raising her kids in a better or healthier way around fear than maybe you were?
Things are so different now than when they grew up, and certainly when I grew up. There was no computers, no cell phones, no any of that stuff. And so they live on their tablets and they live on all of that, which I think is, I'm not in favor of it, but they're not my kids.
Right, right.
It's just part of their standard equipment is having a stupid iPad.
So what do you think Erin's biggest fear around her kids is?
That something might happen to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's normal.
Right. Yeah, that's totally normal. That's going on forever.
Yeah, because, you know, I have two grandsons. They're wild and sometimes quite fearless.
Yeah.
We had my grandson's, she had his eighth birthday party at the rock climbing gym the other day. And it was really fun. But, man, they were just, you know, maybe for like for the first 5 minutes, they were a little like, what is this?
Yeah.
And then as soon as I climbed to the top, they were maniacs. No fear at all.
Yeah.
They were just completely out of control, wild, in an environment that, you know, I know it was safe, but I wouldn't have done what they did.
Right.
It was way too scary.
So how do you teach fear when you need to be fearful?
Well, I think that it's not something you need to teach. I think it's just, it happens mostly, depending how old you are.
Yeah.
You know, all you got to do is, well, I lived in the emergency room when I was a kid. Because I got hurt all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if my grandkids have ever been. I don't think my children have ever been to the emergency room.
Yeah.
But by that time, it was like two or three. I had stitches here and there. And oh, my God, it was a disaster.
Yeah.
It was a very different world.
Yeah.
I mean, I got hit in the head by a baseball bat when I was like 3 years old. Ended up in the emergency room.
I think the ER back then was like the catch-all for anything, too. You know, now it's like, it costs a lot of money to go to the ER now.
Yeah.
So you're like, do you really need to go? Wait till Monday.
I can't even tell you how many times I was laying on the table with, you know, a drape over my face being stitched up or who knows what.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
So it's a much safer world in some ways.
Yeah.
But I really do believe that fear is a big, giant part of everybody's life. And that, you know, they have that stupid saying, there's nothing to fear but fear itself.
Yeah.
I don't think that that's healthy. I think that fear is to be respected and that there are ways to manage it in healthy ways by being really connected to yourself. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you get a life without pain. It doesn't mean you get a life without terrible things happening because there's nobody around that doesn't have pain in their life.
Right.
I don't know anybody.
Yeah.
It's just part of being human.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how connected you are in certain ways. I mean, I am alive because of that connection.
Yeah.
Because I've had brushes with death that the only reason I'm here is because I listened to what my intuition was telling me. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
But it gets back to that, right? Where there is always fear, but it is just taking the step back and listening to your intuition or taking the time to really try to understand it versus just reacting or being afraid of it or lashing out.
Well, and again, I know I was joking about who would I rather live with, but it's really not a joke. Because if all of us were willing to take a step back and realize that none of us are easy to live with, we all have our own quirks and our own things we like to have done a certain way. And the older we get, the more rigid we become.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's important to sort of smile about that and give somebody that you love a bit of a break, even though they're annoying the crap out of you.
Are you talking to me, Dana?
No. Well, maybe. Because, you know. Well, first of all, you're not married to a woman, so certain expectations are never going to be met.
Right, yeah.
But I also say the same thing to some men. You're not married to a man. You have to consider that emotion might be really important to learn how to deal with.
Yeah.
So it works both ways.
Yeah. And do people ever really change?
Well, I don't think inherently a person changes, but I think you can change your behavior, and I think you can change your attitudes.
Yeah.
And I think that you can certainly change the way you feel about yourself, which is much more important than changing yourself.
Yes.
To learn to accept whatever quirks that you bring to the table, to understand that most people don't see the world the way that you do.
Right.
And that, in quotes, the way that you look at the world is not necessarily right, even though it feels right.
No, I think that's really good advice. Just, I've never done this, probably based on my fear of what I'll find out, but really taking stock of yourself.
Uh-huh.
And just, I mean, I feel like I need to go home and write, okay, I'm going to do a little list. Like, what am I so annoying about? Like, what are my quirks that, unfortunately, this person has to live with me? Like, that's probably not a bad idea to really, like, face your uglies. You know, face the stuff that...
And I'm not saying that it's a way of accepting things that are not acceptable.
No.
Right, because I don't want you to be mistreated and disrespected or any of that stuff.
No.
I'm not advocating that people eat shit in order to make their relationships work.
That is never my problem.
Yeah. but reminding yourself of the fact that the people that love you occasionally have to put up with things that are not easy.
Right.
And it's not because you're a bad person.
Yeah.
Because I actually know you're a really lovely person. But that doesn't mean you don't have moments when you're quite difficult to deal with.
100%.
I certainly know I'm that way.
Yeah. I'm so sorry I ordered all those Amazon boxes. I'll send them back. No, I think that's great advice because, again, like, it's the fear that's really holding someone back of looking at themselves and being vulnerable and seeing how they're contributing to, you know, a relationship or a situation or their children or, you know, their family, anything. And it really is like everything in life, just pausing and paying attention to it and thinking about it without just, you know, a reaction behind it.
Well, and I wish more than anything that men could understand that being vulnerable is a gift.
And women.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, men, I agree, is worse, just generally speaking. But I think we're all afraid to be vulnerable.
Uh-huh.
I see it even in my kids where, you know, they'll be wrong about something, which is fine. We're all wrong. But they, they cannot just be like, oh, gosh, yeah, I did that wrong. Or, oh, yeah, it's always like, no, I was going to do that. Or I meant to do that. Well, I already did, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, it's okay. Like, it's, and you see that at such an early age.
Uh-huh.
And it'd be so much a nicer world if we were all like, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Or you're right. I didn't do that the way I probably should have or I said I was going to, et cetera. Uh-huh. And I just think it starts so early. And then men are just, for the, you know, generally speaking, again, are just told that they have to be this certain way and they have to have it always fixed and right. And women too, I have to say, you know, especially in this day and age where it really is hard to be more vulnerable because again, it's back to fear where you're like, it is fearful for me to say that I've done something wrong or made a mistake or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and I know this sounds unrelated, but I think it gets back in some ways to when our kids are first born and the first few years of their life, how we deal with their need for being completely connected to us. Mm-hmm. And how it brings up a lot of shame in people.
Oh, that's so interesting.
To see their infants not being able to live without them, especially when they become toddlers and we want to, in quotes, sleep train them. Mm-hmm. And we want to get them to do things that physiologically and psychologically they're not capable of, which is that idea of self-soothing. Mm-hmm. And that doctors encourage people to leave their kids to, in quotes, cry it out.
Yeah.
And I think that sets the tone for people to feel incredibly abandoned and lonely from a very early age, and that their needs for comfort are shameful and that's problematic. Mm-hmm. And I know it's hugely controversial what I'm saying, because so many people have taught their kids how to sleep way prematurely. But I think that what they teach their kids is how to disconnect from their needs at a very, very early age. And they get to a point where they do eventually fall asleep, but they're also not connected to themselves. Yeah. Because if you think about it, if you had the opportunity to sleep with somebody you love versus sleeping alone, what choice would you make?
Well, it depends on who I'm sleeping with.
No, but I mean, I'm talking about somebody that you're bonded to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how I feel on the whole topic. I think I feel a little bit differently than you do, because I'm also like, well, who's to say that, you know, at some point there is the independence where you do want them to, as you said earlier, to fail, not to fail, but you know what I mean? Where it's like,
yes, okay. But not as a 2 or 3 year old when you don't have the equipment in place to be able to do the things that you're being required to do.
Right.
I'm not talking about as a 7 or 8 year old. I think that by that time, if you've hopefully been helped to feel secure and connected to yourself, it's a lot easier to sleep by yourself than, then, you know, but I've known people that have been tortured in the name of independence as little kids and made to feel really humiliated.
Well, and then there are so many kids that had to be independent. They weren't.
Didn't have a choice.
They didn't have a choice.
Right.
Yeah. And I think those probably suffer even more because.
Yeah.
There was no one to even tell them that. They just had to do it.
Well, and I mean, I had to learn how to take care of myself because there was nobody paying attention to how I felt about anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember as a 7 year old, the only way I could fall asleep was by banging my head against my pillow for hours.
Yeah.
And every night it was the same routine of trying to figure out, it was like I was autistic or something, trying to figure out a way to calm my nervous system because I was so terrified.
Right. And I think every kid is probably different too, because you were probably more of a sensitive kid where you needed that, where someone else might be like, okay, I'm fine. I'm going to bed. I got my blanket. I'm great.
Uh-huh.
That's just that kid too.
Well, I joke around. I've said many times over, I used to steal my dad's bathrobe.
Right.
Because it had his scent on it. And I was more connected to his bathrobe than I was him.
Yeah.
Because at least I could smell that he was there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I, you know, I look back and I think, oh my, you know, drove my dad nuts looking for his bathrobe. And I used to wear shirts all the time too. They were like 10 sizes too big, but it would just help me feel
connected.
Like I wasn't alone in the world. And I would assume that if you're a parent and you see that your kid is suffering in that way, that you might ask yourself, I wonder how come, instead of being annoyed and frustrated, which my parents were.
Right. I think a lot of parents are overwhelmed too.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, my parents did the best they could coming from horrible poverty and awful abuse and all that stuff.
Yeah. Agreed.
So anything else before we finish for today?
I don't think so. No, I think that it's, you know, it's an interesting topic. It's everywhere. It's in our lives. And I think if we can all figure out a little bit way smarter way or a more intuitive way to deal with the fear that we have inside of us and really recognize it as that, we can go a long way.
You know, I just want to say that I, obviously because of what I do, I'm a very biased person, but I think that finding the courage to examine yourself in as much depth as possible and really understand that whatever symptoms that you bring to the table are not the problem. I'm not saying the symptoms aren't a problem, but they're not what the real problem is. And that if you look at your symptoms as a form of communication, it can help unlock the puzzle of why you've always felt the way you have about yourself and what gets in your way of having the kind of relationships you want, maybe the kind of success you're looking for in your financial life. All kinds of stuff can come forward the more that you're willing to take responsibility for yourself and take a look at who you are.
Yeah.
Because without that, you're pretty much lost, in my opinion.
Right. And it takes time and a lot of effort. It's so easy to just go through life, status quo.
Sure.
And it's like this stuff doesn't, I mean, I'm finding in my own life, like this stuff doesn't just uncover itself overnight.
No.
And I think there's a lot of, you know, slips and slides for sure. But it takes a while to peel back those layers.
Yeah.
And it's important. You have one life.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Justine. As usual, it's been a pleasure. Oh. I really appreciate you coming and having this conversation with me.
I'm not afraid of it anymore, Dana. The fear is gone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now here are your hosts, Kim Foskey and Dr. Dana Saperstein.